Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. World's changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. If we just let it be, na 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 na, the world won't get no better. We gotta change it, girl, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. They don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out. They do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me.
That's right. We need some help, y'all. Welcome to Missing Tasia History Radio, MPH Radio. As the voice of MPH Radio, we'd like to welcome you to another episode of MPH Radio. Today's date, July 17, 2021. Today's theme will feature the state, the family, and the children. And specifically, we shall be saying our children. We'll discuss this thing later on with our sister Camille, and we'd like for you at this point in time to take out a pen and pencil and a piece of paper. The order of events will follow, such as we will discuss giving you something to think about as it relates to freedom. We'll share with you some Black mini facts, and then we have a new feature of this program dealing with announcements to our community. We got some very important announcements and events that are coming up within our communities, and we hope that you will take note of it, go out, and support it. After we have done that program out with Brother Alex with his message to the community, that's the order for today, so let's get started. Again, we welcome you to MPH Radio, and we just want to give you something to think about when it comes around to this whole concept of freedom. We know that many people have fought over this concept, have died since the beginning of time. I'm definitely going to lay out just one concept where some people think freedom is, and we are really interested in hearing your feedback at the end of the program on whether or not if you agree with this concept. And the simple definition of the concept of freedom is being an American. That's what we're going to put on the table today. Freedom is being an American. Do you agree with that, and what does that mean? So what do you think about that? So right now, we're going to take a quick station break with music with a purpose, and when we come back, we're going to give you some Black Men in Facts and have some important announcements for you. This is MPH Radio.
I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody's searching for heroes. People need someone to look up to. I never found anyone who fulfilled my needs. So I learned to depend on me. I decided long ago never to walk in anyone's shadow. If I fail, if I succeed, at least I'm living right in life. No matter what they take from me, they can't take away my dignity because of
right. Learning to love yourself and your people along with humanity is the greatest love for all. We welcome you back to MPH Radio. At this point in time, yes, we want to teach our children and you too. We're just going to share with you briefly a few Black Men in Facts for this week on the 11th to the 17th as it relates to African history. So we want you to take heed to this, and here we go. On the 11th day of July, we have the Niagara Movement, predecessor to the NAACP, was founded in 1905. Following on the 12th of this month, Elijah McCord patented the heavy machine for lubrication in 1872. And Africans in Newark, New Jersey, rebelled against capitalist oppression in 1967. On the 14th of this week, Demarc Bracy planned slave rebellion on this date in 1822. Of this week, Africans admitted to segregated public schools in Philadelphia in 1882. On the 16th of July, of this month, Assad Shakur, Revolutionary Warrior, was born in 1947. The first atomic bomb tested by U.S. imperialists sparked nuclear arms race in 1946. Ida B. Wells was born in 1862, and on the 17th date of this month, the Sandinistas of Nicaragua defeated neo-colonial to Moses in 1997. Those are some of our MPH Black Mini Facts, and we hope that, you know, you learn something in terms of the history. As Brother Malcolm taught us, history is best to reward those who research. And now we're going to make this transition to a new segment of this program, dealing with announcements to our community. And we have some very, very important events, unique events that will be taking place pretty soon. And we'd like to bring some of our speed leaders and spokesperson of the various communities to come and share with us the who, the what, the when, the how as it relates to the upcoming events. And we want to encourage you to come out, not only support these events, but find out more about these organizations and try to join them and help them build. Because, again, without organization, we can't do nothing. Organization is a prerequisite to unity. So right now, we can bring in our brother Phil. He's going to introduce himself, talk a little bit about his organization, and the most important event that's going to be taking place on Monday, the 19th, in Richmond, Virginia. Brother Phil, we now going to bring you in, welcome you to MPH Radio, and tell our people a little bit about your organization and the importance of the event that will be taking place on the 19th of this month in Richmond, Virginia. Welcome, Brother Phil.
Hello, Lee. How are you?
Good, good.
And thanks so much for, you know, for inviting us to come on today. The event we're sponsoring on Monday is really important and probably more important every day now. I'm Phil Willato with the Virginia Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality and the editor of our newspaper, the Virginia Defender. The organization was founded in 2002, and we work on a lot of different kinds of issues, and including international ones. Now, a couple of weeks ago, you, Brother Lee, and I were contacted by John Waller with the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organizations, a Cuba solidarity organization based in New York, and told us about this really interesting project that's going on, where a group of seven Cuban Americans who call themselves Puentes de Amor, Bridges of Love, are walking from Miami, Florida, to Washington, D.C., some 1,300 miles, and stopping along the way, and different organizations, local organizations, are hosting them in public meetings to talk about the effects of the 60-year-old U.S. blockade of Cuba on the Cuban people. The group is led by a man named Carlos Lazo, who has a really interesting history. He left Cuba as a young man on a raft, and he didn't make it. And he tried again some years later on a raft again, so-called escaping Cuba. So he is one of the people who initially you would think would be very much opposed to the Cuban Revolution and the Cuban government. But over the years, he has changed his views dramatically. And now he's a warrior against the blockade. Last year, he and another member of his organization rode bicycles from Seattle, Washington, across the country to Washington, D.C., and this year, again, to publicize the effects of suffering. They're basically saying, you know, these are hard journeys, walking from Miami to D.C. In the middle of the summer, you experience some suffering, but it's not anything compared to the suffering of the Cuban people. And so we agreed to host the event, and you are also hosting the organization and with a number of activities this coming week. So we're really happy to be able to work together with you on this project. But once it got off the ground, we had a Facebook page set up, Puentes de Amor, Bridges of Love, a conversation about Cuba. Or people can just go to the website, to the Facebook page, The Virginia Defender, and there's a link to the event page. The protests that we all know about now began in Cuba. Now, it seems to have been a one-day event, but it happened in several cities, and the U.S. media has picked up on it and concentrated on it like it was the second coming. And it's absolutely true that people are suffering in Cuba, and there are shortages of food and medicine. Cuba relies a great deal on tourism. It's a beautiful island, the largest of the Caribbean island, with a tremendous history and beautiful beaches and great people and culture. It's unbelievable. But they had to shut their ports to tourism for most of last year because of COVID-19. And so they took a tremendous hit. And then the Trump administration, on top of the 60-year blockade, which forbids most trade with other countries, the Trump administration imposed more than 240 new sanctions. And those sanctions remain in place, and they forbid Cuban Americans from sending remittances, financial support, to their relatives, and has severely limited travel to the island by plane. And the Biden administration has yet to lift those sanctions. So the squeeze is a full court press against Cuba, very similar to what Washington has done in recent years to Venezuela, to Nicaragua, to Bolivia, to any country that that moves in a progressive leftist revolutionary direction. They consider these countries tremendous threats, not militarily, but ideologically. They demonstrate that you don't have to be part of the American economic empire to survive. So they must be crushed. They set a bad example for the others. So this meeting that we're sponsoring, which will be Monday evening, 6:30 p.m., at Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church, traditionally black church in the city's East End, and that's 1720 Mechanicsville Turnpike. Again, people can just go on the Facebook page for the Virginia Defender and get a link to the meeting with all that information. And Carlos will be speaking. He'll also be performing a song written for the project called Puentes de Amor. And there'll be three introductory speakers, Reverend Rodney Hunter, who is the pastor of Wesley Memorial and has always been very supportive on this issue, Anna Edwards, who chairs the Defenders Sacred Ground Historical Reclamation Project, working on Shaco Bottom. She'll be representing the Defenders, and Brother Lee Robinson from African Awareness Association. And then Carlos will give a presentation, and be open for questions and answers and discussion. And we hope people will take advantage of this unique opportunity to hear from someone who grew up in Cuba, initially, you know, was not satisfied with the situation there, so much so that he risked his life to leave by raft, and then has had a 180-degree turn and blaming the blockade for the suffering of the Cuban people, and is taking extraordinary steps to bring that message to the public. So the meeting, of course, is free. If anybody would like to attend but cannot for any reason, the church will be live streaming the event on its Facebook page, Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church. Again, just go to the Virginia Defender Facebook page for all the information. We ask that because of the continuing COVID-19 crisis, and particularly its effect on the African-American community, we ask that anyone who is not fully vaccinated watch the event online. And for those who are coming, please wear a mask, and we'll be meeting in the upstairs church sanctuary, which is quite large, so we can socially distance. So again, Monday, 6:30 p.m., Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church, 1720 Mechanicsville Turnpike, Puentes de Amor, Bridges of Love, with a presentation by Carlos Lazo, Cuban-American, opposing the blockade against Cuba. Please come out. Please support the event. And hopefully we can open up some minds and put some pressure on Washington to end this. I should just mention that when they get to Washington, there's going to be a mass rally in D.C., and that's being organized. It's going to take place at Lafayette Park across the street from the White House. The information on that event will be posted hopefully today on the Virginia Defender website. So thanks very much, Lee, for sparing this time. And we look forward to seeing you on Monday and everyone else, hopefully, who's listening to this broadcast.
And Bob Field, quickly again, give them the website information where they can find in a contact number again.
On Facebook, go to The Virginia Defender. That's the newspaper's Facebook page, and there's a link there to the event. It's the first item on the Facebook page.
All right. We'd like to thank you, Brother Phil, for all the work you're doing into our community. This is a very special and unique program. Please come out and support it, and Phil will be staying in touch. We thank you.
Terrific. Thank you. Thank you so much, Lee. Really. Take care.
All right. Next, we'll be going to our next announcement. We'll be going to our brother, Jabril. He is with the African Community Network. He can come and share with you about who he is, his organization, but more important, they have a very important African festival that coming up soon in Richmond, Virginia, and he can talk a little bit about that. So right now, we can bring our brother in, and I'd like to welcome him to MPH Radio. Brother Jabril, welcome to MPH Radio.
All right. Thank you so much, Brother Lee. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jabril Nyang. I'm originally from West Africa, Senegal, and I am the president of the African Community Network, commonly called ACN. This is a nonprofit organization we created in 2008. So we've been working, trying to, bring the African diaspora together, and especially the immigrants who came here to the U.S. And settled here in Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, and the great area. We're trying to serve as a support of resources for these immigrants, and also trying to bridge the gap between the African newcomers and other communities. As you know, it's very difficult when you move from another country to a new country to start all over. So with this organization, we're trying to make it easy for the immigrants to navigate the system and to know how to get resources and how to connect. One of the things that we do, we have four big events every year. We do one, which is the health fair, where we just trying to service people who don't have health coverage, mainly anybody. We do that event always in the Churchill area around April, where people can come and check their health, and just we bring a lot of partners, some people from the military service, eye doctor, dentist, everything. So just to help out with people who need some service and don't have the means to get to some of the places to be checked. Other things we do is just we're trying to make some training so people can learn what is available to them through different agencies, like social service or like the workforce development, the colleges. We're trying to connect them with, the resources we can find needed in our community. Also, we have this very important event we do, the celebration of Africa Day. During the celebration of Africa Day, we're just trying to give more information about Africa because, as we all know, there is a lot of misunderstanding of the continent. So through that Africa Day, we just use that opportunity to connect and inform and teach people about Africa. So that's one of the very important things. I think 2 years ago, last year we didn't have it because of the COVID, but the previous year we had this big meeting with another group of brother and sister from here who were born from centuries in the United States. And we had this little round table talk just to clear some misunderstanding we may have. And that was a very successful program. And the fourth program we do every year is the Afrofest, the African Festival, which we call Afrofest. This is our third year doing the Afrofest. And this Afrofest, we do it in partnership with the city of Richmond because, we've been just working behind the scenes trying to, organize the African community. Then that, you know, we was connected with the city in some way, and they was thinking that it is interesting that they can just join us, just to do a, and just have this festival in the city, just to also again bring awareness of the contribution of the African people, you know, in every level of the government, you know, the city and the state, you know, because you can tell when you go to any hospital, you can see a lot of, you know, doctors from Africa working there in a school system. We are there, but we never, you know, show anything. Nobody get acknowledged or anything like that. And, you know, this is a way to showcase the contribution and just to educate people about the culture, you know, African culture, and just to make sure that the African people know that they are important to the fabric of the city, of the state, of the country, and of the world. So we have many countries, you know, out of 54 countries of Africa. The first festival, we had the participation of 21 countries. So almost we can say half of Africa was available to showcase their country during the festival. And that's what we intend to do every year, and to grow the participation of different countries. If we know that there are some people from Uganda or people from, you know, the Congo, you know, and we just bring them on. And then during the festival, they come and we set up countries by countries by countries. Under each tent, there will be a country. And then when you talk to those folks from different countries, they can tell you exactly what you need to know about their specific country. You know, knowing that, you know, Africa is very diverse, but, you know, almost the culture is similar one place to another, you know, and that's the goal, just to educate and to connect. So this Afrofest is going to take place this year in September the 18th. And we would love to have all our brothers and sisters on the call, share the information, and just show and support the day. And then, you know, let's connect and work together. That's the message I want. And we really wanted to thank Mr. Phil, who spoke earlier. Also wanted to thank Brother Lee, and also everybody who's on the call. Again, thank you for the opportunity to share with you this information. Thank you.
And Brother Jabril, can you tell the people again how they can contact you, those who are interested in participating in the event, or being a part of it?
Right. So we're going to be, we have a Facebook page, and we have a website, which is also, we are redoing it now. But the Facebook, if you just check ACN, African Community Network, Richmond, you can see the information there. We can see, you know, we post there all the new information, the event, and everything else. So that's the best way to contact us. And also, we have the email, I'm going to say it is ACN at gmail.com. acnrva@gmail.com, acnrva@gmail.com. That way, you know, you can connect to, with us. Also, I'm going to give a phone number, 804-389-4488. If you need any information, you call that number, and then we can you know, give you any more information you may need.
All right, my brother, we'd like to thank you and your organization for the work that it is doing in our communities. We wish y'all much success and keep us informed. We always have a platform open to you and your organization. So we thank you for your announcements today. We thank you.
Thank you so much, Brother Lee.
All right, you listen to MPH Radio. We're going to take a station break with music with a message. When we come back, we're going to speak to our theme, a very important theme, the state, the family, and the children. We're our sister Camille, don't you go nowhere. We recognize beneath the conditions of our people today, they actually have us living on the front line. We'll be right back. This is MPH Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to MPH Radio. Oh, you got me living on the front line. Did you have me born at the wrong time? I don't know, but we're going to find out right now with our beautiful sister Camille. She will speak to our topic today, the state, the family, and the child. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the institution of child protection custody. Are they really protecting our children? Are they really in the best interest of our family? Not only do we make history, but we also live it. And we have a sister here. We're going to bring her on right now. We're going to ask her to speak to the dean. But not only do we, like I said, we make history, we live it. And Sister Camille, we'd like to welcome you back to MPH Radio. We'd ask you to tell us a little brief background of who you are. And we'd like for you to tell your story. We want you to fill in this page as it relates to this whole concept of the state, the family, the children, particularly dealing with the very institution as it relates to our family, our children. So right now, we're going to turn the mic over to you, Camille. And Camille, let's start filling in our missing pages of the history. The mic is yours.
I'm Camille
Landry.
Yes, can you hear me? I live in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. All right. I'm in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. But this is an American story I'm telling. This is a story that affects our communities. This is a story that more than almost anything else, any other factor in the lives of African people in the United States, reflects the disproportionate nature of the way that we are treated by all of the institutions in our communities. We're talking about the institutions of policing, of so-called corrections, or better, incarceration. We're talking about social services. We're talking about employment. We're talking about health care, particularly mental health care, but often health care in general. We're talking about differences in housing. We're talking about the education system and how all of these systems combined fail African American people. However, they are very successful at one thing, which is the continuation of oppression of people of Africa in the United States. So this story is really hard to hear, and it's even harder to tell. I'm going to use some strong language, and I'm going to show you some even stronger imagery. This story might make you vomit, and it might make you scream. I hope that this story makes you stand up and say, oh no, no more, no justice, no peace. It's really seldom that I cannot find my voice, that events are so painful and so outrageous that I can't even fix my mouth to say anything, but this is one of those times. And when I try to tell this story, most of what comes out is wounded howls and words that would peel the paint off of a battleship. But I'm going to try, because what happened to my family is not an outlier. It is not a rarity, and it is not by any means confined to the state of Oklahoma. Although in most all things, Oklahoma does a worse job of it than almost anywhere else on the planet. The state of Oklahoma took my child away. She came home this month, but the state of Oklahoma seized my daughter and imprisoned her in a home with a stranger in a suburb among people of a different race, where she was allowed no contact with anybody except the birth mother, whom she really never knew. She couldn't talk to her siblings, her friends, from unrelated to unrelated adults who've known and cared about her forever, like clergy and teachers and youth leaders. They said it was for her own good, but they did it. It's called medical kidnapping, and it happens more often than you might think in America. In my case, I was accused of lying to doctors and faking my child's medical symptoms, even though there were medical tests, videos, and witnesses by other competent adults, including medical practitioners, teachers, and other people over whom I have no control. Nonetheless, the Department of Human Services took my child out of my arms and then held her unable to contact anybody until she admitted that she had been abused. even when she said she hadn't been abused. This is at the age of 14 and a half years, by the way. And so they forced her into a different custody arrangement, forced an adoption from which she ran running as soon as she was legally able to come back home. Now, this child was not a child to whom I had given birth. This is a child that I had raised since the age of 5 and a half months. And that's an important issue in the legal standing of the things. But it's a perfect illustration of how this, there's no other word for it but bullshit, can come down out of the sky and rest itself upon your family and tear your family apart. This is a story that's repeated all over the United States every day, because on any given day, there are nearly 424,000 children in foster care in the United States. In 2019, which is the last year for which I could get good numbers, over 672,000 children spent time in foster care in the United States. And on average, these kids remain in state care for over a year and a half, and 5% of children in foster care stay there for 5 or more years. Interestingly enough, which probably shouldn't surprise you at all, African children are more affected than children of other races, okay? And there are reasons for that. As of now, you know, as of this date, using current census data, the best as we can get, Black youth were 5 times more likely to end up in foster care than white youth. Black children account for about 24% of the children in foster care, although we only make up 14% of the country's children aged 18 or younger. They're also more likely to be placed in a group home where there's additional trauma and abuse. These children often die in custody, okay? And they are often abused in custody, both physically, emotionally, and sexually. They're often held in custody and then kicked to the curb when they turn 18 and or graduate from high school. No social support system, because the ties of family have been broken by the child welfare system. And the foster families, whether they're in it for love or for money, don't get any support and are unable to care for these children or unwilling to care for these children. And so there are terrible outcomes for these children when they are punted from foster care. Now, one of the things that it's really important to understand, that if you plot state's prison population alongside the number of kids in custody in the state, the number of children that the state tears away from their families, you'll see that the two groups shadow each other very closely. And in fact, they're very closely related. They don't just mirror each other. The relationship is causative. And by that, I mean that the high rate of incarceration in this country increases the number of children in state custody and vice versa. This isn't the new Jim Crow. My sisters and brothers, this is the new auction block, because you know what else? There is money involved. Mom says, well, those kids must have been in great danger. Otherwise, why would the state tear them away from their families? And in some cases, you'd be correct. But in far too many issues of child removal, the major causative factor is poverty. Poor people lose their homes. Poor people have trouble keeping food on the table, keeping the lights on. And most of all, poor people can't afford treatment for mental health and substance abuse problems. It's very well established that Black, brown, and red people use drugs at a lower rate than whites, but we are several times more likely to be locked up for doing so. And being locked up is a major reason for DHS to take your kids. Doesn't matter much what you're locked up for. It could be shoplifting. It could be murder. It could be unpaid traffic tickets and not having insurance that can land your Black behind in the county jail until you can come up with the money to pay your fines, and you can lose your children for that. What about the others? One of the problems is there's a Japanese proverb that says, when the only tool you have is a hammer, a nail. Okay? DHS, in most, the Department of Human Services and Child Protective Services in most states in the union is one of the largest, if not the largest, state department. And so the more tools you have, the more tools you're going to use. DHS is like the guy with a new tool, biggest agency in the state, and it's on one all the time. These people have to be used. Now, I mentioned money. There's money in child removal, and there's even more money in forced child adoption. The federal government gives money to states for each child that they move from foster care to adoption. Several hundred dollars per child. It varies with the age of the child, whether there are multiple children in the family and so forth. Plus, the federal government gives money to the states for everything that Human Services does prior to the adoption of the child. This amounts to thousands of dollars per month out of state and federal coffers into the Department of Human Services. What's more, in the last 20 years, there has been a trend in the United States of taking functions that used to be performed by the child, by the government, by state and governments, and shifting them to contracted services. The good old boy network is alive and well in America. In many states in the country, including in the state of Oklahoma, the majority of children in foster care are being handled, are being administrated, their cases are being administered by private organizations. Now, they're nonprofits usually. Many of them are religiously affiliated, okay? The vast majority of them are Christian. I was unable to find more than one or two in the entire nation that are not Christian if they have a religious affiliation. And these organizations take government money and then administer services to the people of our states based upon their own principles. Now, some of these principles are lovely principles. Children should be loved. Children should be cared for. Some of these principles reflect the inherent systemic racism in the United States. It's a $75.5 million industry in the state of Oklahoma alone. You can hear about the direct money, that's $75.5 million, not the other money that comes in and gets spread around, often through nonprofit organizations that support foster children or that support foster families. But it represents a multi-billion dollar industry in the nation as a whole. Okay? So I want you to think for a minute that about what happens when you have an industry, an institution, any institution that represents that many dollars, and what happens with that money and how that money drives decision making. Think about the prison industry. Every time the legislature starts talking about reforms to incarceration, representatives from those districts where prisons are the biggest employer in town vote no. They get their colleagues to vote no. No to reform, no to reduction in the numbers of people who are locked up, no to alternatives to sentencing. And the same thing is true of the foster care system. You don't take those kids out of their homes, then the money doesn't flow and people don't keep their jobs. State officials say they're doing what's in the best interest of the child, but the state has a financial incentive to remove children. The thousands of dollars it takes from the government for every child every month, cases, child, for instance, is Native American, it's an even greater amount of money. In South Dakota, more than half of the children in foster care are indigenous children, even though they only make up 15% of the child population. That's another total racket. So you say, all right, so the system is making money, but aren't they protecting vulnerable children? And sometimes they do. We all see these stories about children who've been horribly abused, terribly neglected. But sometimes it isn't about neglect of the children. One of the effects of spending on all these billions of dollars on taking kids is that there's less money available for saving kids. Now, there is a mindset among Child Protective Service workers that they're professionals, that they're the most qualified individuals to determine what a family needs, not the family, not extended family, not the community. It's kind of like the dude with the new power tool again. If your favorite tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But there's another factor here, and that is in the court system that handles these family law cases, it's totally separate from the usual court system. They take the kids first, and then they go to court. Months and months later, almost 100% of the time, DHS prevails. In other words, the courts listen to the social workers and not to the families, and there isn't a damn thing that the families can do about it. In more than 90% of all cases, families lose in court. Unlike in a criminal court or a civil court that deals with most judicial matters in America, in these family courts, people might not even get an opportunity to present their side of the story. You don't have a voice. And the general rules of procedure and rules of evidence simply do not apply. Let me give you an example. Somebody I know personally came to me for help. His mom was in a car accident. Her toddler was in a back seat into a car seat. Nobody was hurt. It was caused because the mama fell asleep at the wheel. Mom works two jobs. They test mom for drugs, and they search her car, and they don't find anything. But the arresting officer says, "I smell marijuana." So DHS took the child who was in the car and then goes to the grandma's house where the other children are and literally tears one of the babies out of his grandmother's arms. Grandmother, by the way, is a licensed foster care parent caring for other children for eight. And is saying, "This child is safe here with me. Leave my flesh and blood child with me until you get this straight." But DHS says, "No, we can't trust you. You're a member of the family." So Mama comes to court and says, "Hey, my drug test came up negative. They found no drugs in my car. What's up with this?" And DHS says, "Well, you had a drug problem a few years ago, and we're just making sure your kids are safe and protected." So you heard that right. Mama's not using. She had a clean drug test, a clean urine test, a clean hair follicle test, which tests drug use back for several months. No drugs found, but a history of drug abuse. Feels like she's losing her mind. Her babies are gone. They won't allow her to see them except to go to the institution and visit them with other people standing there. In a couple of months, she's homeless because despite she's working two really crappy jobs at a fast food place and Family Dollar, she doesn't make enough money to pay rent because, by the way, there is no state in the union where minimum wage full-time is enough to pay rent on a two-bedroom apartment, and this mother had four children and needed a three-bedroom apartment. So she's getting assistance, which also comes through DHS and the Department of Housing, but they coordinate it. So when DHS tells the housing authority that the mama no longer has custody of the kids, what does the housing authority say? They say, "You got to get out of this house. We're helping you pay for it. You don't qualify anymore." So the mama moves in with a friend. She's sleeping on the sofa of somebody who does use drugs all the time. She's homeless. She's lost her babies. She can't afford an attorney. And if she gets a public assistant, they're paid by the same people that took her kids away. And she can't get this to even return a phone call. And the buddy that she's crashing with says, "Hey, baby, why don't you hit this pipe? It'll make you feel better." And the mama says, "What the heck?" And she hits the pipe. Next day, DHS shows up at the door, demanded a random drug test, and the first time in over 2 years, the mama tests positive. It's downhill from there. DHS says go to treatment, but the mama has no insurance, and her crappy Family Dollar job does not provide anything in the way of benefits, neither does the part-time gig stocking shelves and bagging groceries, okay? And there's a wait list for free drug treatment, and all the free treatment facilities in this state are run by churches who will not deal with you if you're not a practicing Christian. But even if she does find treatment, it's too late because DHS has moved and these kids are gone. One's been sent to live with his father, who just happens to be one of the biggest drug dealers in the neighborhood. Nice guy, but he swings for a living, but he looks good. Nice car, nice suit. The baby who was torn from his grandmama's arms has spiraled into madness, cries, and messes his pants. But he's now in special therapeutic foster care. The state pays almost double for that. First foster mama locked him in a laundry room for soiling his pants, and the second one did something that scared the child so badly he ran out of the house saying that the woman was going to kill him. He's now in his sixth foster home within a year's time. His sisters are a distant memory. The six-year-old was seen on camera in a store being slapped by her foster mother. And these kids are so lucky because now they're safe, and the benevolent state, which knows better than anybody else what to do for them and their mom, has destroyed their family. And the kids are living in a hell that you cannot even imagine. Those kids are never coming back to their mama. They are legally orphans. DHS didn't listen to the mama's pastor who said she was clean, worked hard, cared for her children, took them to school, they did their homework, took them to church. DHS didn't listen to the grandmama. Remember, she is a professional foster parent, okay? Deacon in her church, raised dozens of children, said that the kids were fine and what was needed was that the mama needed help. So she didn't have to work so many hours, and so that she could stay straight. She needed both mental health and substance abuse care. She needed help with the bills, like so many people. She needed a minimum wage that would pay the rent and keep her lights on. Didn't listen to her, okay? And so the children are gone. And what happens to these children after they are gone? This is one of the biggest failures of the foster care system. So you've got a huge number of children in foster care, and our statistics show that of the number of people who are incarcerated in America, over 30% of those children have been foster children. And the number of people in, I'm talking about prison incarceration, the number of children who have been, of people rather, in county jails, and you understand the difference between being incarcerated in county jail for misdemeanors or minor felonies, as opposed to having a state prison system. The number of children, of people in county jails who have been foster children rises in some jurisdictions to over 75%. Kids who have been in foster care lag behind the general population, behind their peers, when it comes to graduating high school or getting a job. Those kids are so much more likely to have bad outcomes in life that last for the entirety of their lives than kids who have not been in foster care. 30% of kids who enter the juvenile justice system are there for placement-related behavioral cases. In other words, running away from a foster home or a group home. A quarter of young people leaving foster care are going to be incarcerated within a few years after they turn 18, and 50% of young people leaving foster care are going to be unemployed within a few years of turning 18. 70% of inmates in California state prisons and 80% of people in Illinois prisons are former foster care youth. I don't know what those numbers are for Oklahoma because the state chooses not to track them. One-third of the kids leaving foster care end up homeless. 35% of them are arrested while they're in foster care. 20% of children living in runaway shelters come directly from foster care. Kids placed in foster care, regardless of the reason, that they were there, regardless of whether their parents did drugs or not, are at higher risk of developing alcohol and drug programs. And nearly 60% of young males who spent time in foster care had been convicted of a crime, compared with 10% of young men of similar demographic backgrounds who've never been in care. 75% of girls leaving foster care are on public assistance by 24, and most of them are mothers. They're three times as likely not to finish high school or even get a GED, half as likely to go to college at all, and only one-fifth as likely as the general population to have a college degree. Half of former foster care youth go hungry, get evicted, have utilities that are shut off, and nearly a quarter of foster youth have been the victims of violence during the past 12 months alone. It's so bad that children's rights advocacy groups have shut down the foster care systems in several states in the United States and placed them under court supervision. From the decade of 2000 to 2011, 129 kids died in custody of just the Oklahoma State child welfare system. A few were medically fragile, but the rest were healthy, thriving human beings who died in suspicious or criminal settings, away from their families, far from anybody who loved them. A children's rights attorney by the name of Marsha Robinson Laurie said, "Foster care systems established and funded to serve children are failing. They produce only more damaged people who will go on to produce new generations of damaged children who will continue to lead unspeakably tragic lives and who will increasingly tax our public resources." Now, here is a statistic that blew my mind. You say, okay, obviously some of this is related to systemic racism, but Black social workers or caseworkers, statistically, in study after study, are harder on Black families, and that families who are serviced, if that's the right word, who are contacted by African-American social workers are more likely to have their children removed than white social workers. One of the reasons for this is that there is suspicion. Okay, let me back up a little bit. Black people use a village to care for our children. If you are a person of Africa in the United States, the odds are you have spent time with your grandmama, with big mama, you've spent time with aunties, with uncles, with cousins, with your mom's best friend. We know that it takes a village to raise a child, but very specifically, the poorer you are, the more you have to rely upon systems of care, informal systems of care. You can't afford decent child care, you send your kids to your auntie. You can't afford, you know, you want to be able to go back to school and while you're holding down a job, your kids might go live with your parents or your in-laws for a period of time because we have fewer resources and we utilize the much better and more productive resources of our villages. But often, when Child Protective Services looks at these systems, they say, well, what kind of mama are you when for 18 months your kids live with your auntie? What kind of mama are you when your kids stay at their grandmama's house from Monday through Friday and go to school from there and you only keep them on the weekend or whenever you happen to be off? And this works against families who then find themselves with contact with the Department of Human Services, who judge them based upon, and this is an official metric, based upon the number of weeks or months that the children have been out of the care of their parents. So the very systems that help Black families survive and thrive are turned against them. And for reasons that nobody can quite pin down, having a Black caseworker seems to affect children more negatively, affect these assessments more negatively. I don't know why it is, although I do know that there are other statistics having to do with the way African people black people in America in the criminal justice system and in others and in the education system are often negatively impact our own communities based on using a set of rules that rewards proximity and similarity to white social systems. That's the subject for a whole nother conversation. But the bottom line is our children are being taken away. The system is failing their children. It is destroying families. It is destroying the children themselves, and it is destroying our communities. In the neighborhood where I live and where I have a bookstore, children who attend the local high school and its theater schools have one or more parent who is or has been incarcerated or on paper under control, probation or parole of the criminal justice system. And the ratio, the numbers of children who land themselves in out of family care, whether it is informal relative placement, go stay with your grandmama while you know your mother does time, or whether it is official removal of the children from their parents, is also very, very high. Another thing that really contributes to the number of black children in foster care is the school-to-prison pipeline, because all of this mess is intersectional, okay? So you've got public schools with zero tolerance discipline, and black students, according to all statistics, all studies, black students are disproportionately receiving harsher punishment than white children. In terms of multiple suspensions, 51% of the kids in public school are white, 16% of them are black, but multiple suspensions, 31% of white children make up those kids who get multiple suspensions, and 42% of the kids receiving multiple suspensions are black children. Black kids represent 31% of school-related arrests because our schools are populated with armed police officers. Things like chewing gum in the hall or shoving your best friend because you're horsing around are likely to get you put in handcuffs, stuff that wouldn't have even gotten you sent to the principal's office when you or I were in school, and at worst would have resulted in your mama coming to school to pick you up and then consequences when you get home. But nowadays, 31% of the kids arrested, I mean handcuffed and taken downtown, are black children. And black kids are suspended and expelled more than three times as often as white students. Most of these violations are what you call discretionary violations. In other words, if you bring a gun to school, that's a fact. I see you, I see the gun, you're going to get expelled, okay? A discretionary violation is one in which your teacher sends the kid down to the office, says, this kid was talking back to me. Well, what constitutes talking back? You know, what is the relationship of the teacher to the student in general? None of these things are the discretionary violations. And the kids who are victims to that are nearly three times more likely to be in contact with the juvenile justice system the following year. Often, when kids are incarcerated or arrested, what happens after the so-called criminal justice system comes in is that DHS follows and removes these children from their home. They say the parents are unable to control their children. And so the kid ends up in foster care. Okay? So this is what I mean when I say that these issues are intersectional, that all of these other systems of oppression are combining to remove, to destroy black families. And our children are paying the price. One of the questions in social services is what constitutes maltreatment, okay? Many people believe that spanking a child is maltreatment. I happen to be one of them. But child maltreatment is more likely to be substantiated when families are African or indigenous than when they're Caucasian. In other words, if I spank my child, it's more likely to be considered criminal and child maltreatment than if the person doing the spanking is white. Instead of being referred to foster care, 40% of Latinx children receive services in their homes. 44% of African children receive home services, but 72% of Caucasian children are served in their homes, where a team of social workers and psychologists and other people come into the home, keep the children with their families. 51% of the kids who entered foster care placement in the United States were children of color, but only 46% of those were Caucasian. The difference is kids of unidentified race or of mixed race. But the median length of stay for African children is 18 months, for Caucasian children, 10 months. Our black children are more than twice as likely or more foster homes as white children are in the same length of time, and they receive fewer services while they're in foster care. Some research shows that families of color compared with white families have less contact with child welfare workers, receive fewer services, and are substantially less likely to receive services in their home. Black foster parents reported fewer hours of contact between social workers and their children than was reported by other racial or ethnic groups. So we're talking about a system that is lopsided. We're talking about a system that is unbalanced. We're talking about a system that is racist. And we're talking about a system that tears apart families. Now, in the case of my own removal of my precious child, that child turned 18, graduated from high school, used her own money, earned it a crappy job, bought a plane ticket, and returned home. But in her own words, she says, "I am broken. The things that happened to me broke me." I said to her, "It's time for you to choose college or a career." And she said, "There's no point in making plans because regardless of what you do, somebody with a badge and a gun can step in and break your life into a million pieces." This is true. You heard the statistics about the outcome for children who have been in foster care. What's the alternative, you might ask? Well, in my research, I looked at the way different states deal with this. And one really superlative program is coming out of the state Missouri, where instead of removing children from their homes, they instead assign a mentor that acts like an auntie or a godmother and goes in and cares for the family, visits the family on a regular basis like an auntie or a grandmama or a godmama would do, provides information and support to the parents, provides information and support, a friendly ear, a friendly lap to the baby. Your baby won't start screaming and you think you're going to lose it and start to use drugs again. Call your mentor mama to come over, sit with this baby, tell you that you're doing a good job, explain to you that her babies did the same thing and it's not something that the mama who's having problems did. Explain and provide support, provide emotional support, and connect those families to the services that they need. Your hours got cut at your Walmart job and you're afraid your lights are going to be turned off, let me make the phone call that connects you to the service agency in your county that can help you pay this light bill. Let me tell you some ways in which you can save money on your food bill so that at the end of the month when your food stamps, your SNAP benefits run out, your kids aren't healthy. Let me show you how to cook. You might not have learned it because your mama might have been absent from the house, because this trauma is generational, my people. I'm going to wind up here. I know I've been talking a lot, and I hope that the audience has some stories that they can tell and some feedback for this. But the bottom line of this to me is that the institutions in this country have fundamental systemic racism, and that racism affects us from before we are born, from the moment of conception until the moment of death. We know that black mamas are more likely to die in childbirth, and black babies are more likely to die before or shortly after they're born. We know that black people have shorter lifespans. We know that the burdens of racism weigh on us heavily and shorten the number of breaths that we take in this lifetime. When I say that we need to rise up and liberate ourselves, I'm talking about across the board. I'm talking about systems of oppression that disguise themselves as systems of assistance. I'm talking about assumptions about the way our families work and what's good and what is not good. I'm talking about the intersectionality of all of these institutions, these racist institutions, these powerful institutions that have an impact upon our people in this country. And I'm saying, sisters and brothers, we have to make changes. Lee, I'm turning it over to you.
Thank you, my sister. We listened to Sister Camille as she addressed our theme today, the state, the family, and the children. We'd like to take a break with music with a message, and when we come back, we will continue the discussion and we will open up our phone line. If you have any comments, views based upon what has been shared with you, we'd like for you to hit 1 and we would call out your last 4 numbers. We're going to our break, come back, and our phone lines will be open, and we will continue the discussion, the state, the family, and the children. This is MPH Radio. We'll be right back. And this record goes to a tribute to the mothers. And that's not to disconcern ourselves with the fathers, but we know historically the mothers have been given a great responsibility to carry on the nurturing of our children. We'll be right back.
When I was pregnant in jail, I thought I was going to have a baby and the baby would never be with me, but I was acquitted a month and 3 days before Tupac was born. I was real happy because I had a son.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the street. So back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, scared to go home. I was the fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Said tears with my baby sister. Over the years we was poor than other little kids. And even though we had different days, the same drama when things were wrong, we blame mama. I reminisce on the stress I caused. It was hugging on my mama from a jail cell. And who's taking elementary? Hey, I see the penitentiary one day. Running from the police, that's right. Mama catch me, put a whoop into my backside. And even as a queen, mama, you always was the black queen, mama. I finally understand, for a woman it ain't easy trying to raise a man. You always was committed, a poor single mother on welfare. Tell me how you did it, there's no way I can pay you back. But the plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. Dear mama, there ain't nobody tell us it was fair. No love for my daddy cause the coward wasn't there. He passed away and I didn't cry, cause my anger wouldn't let me feel for a stranger. They say I'm wrong and I'm heartless, but all along I was looking for a father, he was gone. I hung around with the thugs, and even though they showed a young brother love, I moved out, started really hanging. I needed money of my own, so I'm banging. I ain't guilty, cause even though I said it feels good putting money in your mailbox, I love paying rent when the rent's due. I hope you got the diamond necklace that I sent to you. Cause when I was low, you was there for me. You never left me alone because you cared for me. And I could see you coming home after work late. You're in the kitchen trying to fix us a hot plate. Just working with the scraps she was given, and
mama made miracles every Thanksgiving. But now the road got rough, you're alone, trying to raise two bad kids on your own. And there's no way I can pay you back, but my plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. And dear mama, you all appreciate it. Pour out some liquor and I reminisce, cause through the drama I can always depend on my mama. And when it seems that I'm hopeless, you say the words that can get me back in focus. When I was sick as a little kid, to keep me happy there's no limit to the things you did. And all my childhood memories, I'm full of all the sweet things you did for me. And even though I act crazy, I gotta thank the Lord that you made me. There are no words that can express how I feel. You never kept a secret, always stayed real. And I appreciate how you raised me, and all the extra love that you gave me. I wish I could take the pain away. If you can make it through the night, there's a brighter day. Everything will be alright if you hold on. It's a struggle every day, gotta roll on. There's no way I can pay you back, but my plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. Dear mama, you all appreciate it. Dear mama,
to their mothers, yes, you are very dear, and many times I ask me and I show it, but we want you to know we do love you. We welcome you back to MPH Radio. We're discussing our theme today, the state, the family, and children. As we listen to our sister Camille tell her story in one of the many missing pages, as it relates to the history and the struggle of African families in the Western Hemisphere, and more particularly right now, we talk about the United States, it brings back the memories of enslavement when we talk about physical enslavement. As it relates to the family, the relationship, the mothers and the fathers, and how they have historically done things to keep our kids separated, divided, confused, and damaged mentally in terms of the mindset of our children. Now, one of the questions could be I'd like to raise with you and just get your response is that when you have a problem and if you don't come up with the right assessments or diagnose it correctly, it will lead you to many roads, and going down these roads, they may not cure or solve the problem. Listen to your story. One man will argue that there seems to be a message that the state itself has declared the African family as the enemy to the state. I'm just general in terms of that prognostic. Your response to that, Sister Camille?
I think about on. One of the biggest issues, one of the biggest factors in whether or not your children are taken is your proximity to whiteness, that you're either white or that your family structure, the way you present yourself is more, quote, mainstream America, which really means proximity to white folks. There is war being perpetrated upon black families in America by the systems, the very systems that are supposed to be here to educate, to provide medical treatment, to provide social services, to provide a safety net, even to provide corrections in terms of people who engage in criminal behavior in the health system, especially in the mental health system. These systems, by their very nature, in what they claim to be a manner of helping people, are actually destructive toward our families. And it's not a new story. It's not a new story at all. My great-grandfather, who was born right after slavery, tells the story of how when both of his parents died, his younger children, his younger siblings were taken away to a workhouse, and they did laundry and those kinds of things for people in what was, in fact, virtual slavery, because there was nobody to care for them. So from the time that we were placed on the auction block to the time that we allegedly received our freedom, throughout the period of Jim Crow and throughout this issue of the new Jim Crow, this era of mass incarceration, the very institutions that are supposed to protect us are actually tearing our families apart. We have no control over them. We have little control over them. And even when we work for them, when we infiltrate these systems, we are still forced by the systems themselves to rely upon their assessments of what is good and what is proper and what is appropriate. And it's tearing our families apart.
Well, Camille, you said something earlier, and you used something, the term or medical something. I can't remember right now, but I would like for you to respond to, it seems to me, if your mother or if your father, you're taking care of your children and they get sick, and if you don't have the cure to that sickness and you don't take them to the doctor, you might be accused of being a neglectful parent, and they use that
right.
as a pretext of taking the kids. While on the other hand, children get sick and you take them to the hospital, and they perceive that you're taking them too many times, even though it's a basis for it, then they use that again as a means to take your children away, which I think in that case, that's one of the things that happened to you. So what is the solution? What do we do?
I'm not really sure what the solution is, but I do know that in many of the states, there are parent advocacy groups of people who have been victimized by these processes, who have come together to support each other and also to change the systems. In the state of Oklahoma, for instance, the DHS was put under federal court supervision. The same thing has happened in multiple other states and even the District of Columbia, where because of children's rights advocacy groups and parents' family advocacy groups, DHS has been curbed to some degree. Is that a total solution? No. This is a huge system. As I said, multi-billions of dollars pass through this system every year in America. And so it is, you know, this is a David versus Goliath kind of situation. But one of the things that people can do, whether you've been affected or not, is to reach out to children's rights advocacy groups and to these family advocacy groups and work with them. And I really urge families, grandparents whose children have been snatched from their grasp, to reach out to these supportive groups. I had one sister come and tell me that her young daughter, who has mental illness, not substance abuse, but, you know, a diagnosed mental illness, had the child taken away. And DHS refused to let the grandmother take custody of the child because the grandmother's former husband, the father of some of her children, had a felony drug conviction. He didn't live there. They had been divorced for years, but he comes over to visit his children and, you know, as a father should. And this was the reason that this beautiful African child was taken and placed for adoption with a Caucasian family. And I have nothing against interracial adoption in general, by the way. It's a lot better to grow up in a family than it is to grow up in foster care. But was taken away and adopted out because the social workers made judgments about this family, the child's family of origin, based on their ideas of what constituted good families. This mother is graduated from college, worked her way through college. Her other children, the ones who don't suffer from mental illness, which is an illness, not a choice, the children are brilliant, beautiful, well-accomplished, good students and that kind of stuff. But the mother fought like hell for that grandbaby and pissed those people off, and that baby is gone. A similar thing really happened to me. The fact that I came out swinging, ultimately worked against me. If you comply, if you say, yes, y'all are right and I'm wrong, you're less likely to have your children taken. But if you try to take the babies away from a mouse, that mouse is going to die trying to save her babies. Okay, so that is human nature, and it is the way the world is supposed to work. But again, the system works against you because just like being non-compliant with the police, hey, man, I didn't do anything wrong. Why are you putting your knee on my neck? It's likely to result in your death or the death of your family. This mess is connected. This is intersectional. This is part. This is why critical race theory is important, because they're screaming. Critical race theory says all white people are racist and it's hurting our babies. Critical race theory says look at the numbers. Look at the effects of these actions. And when these actions are disproportionately affecting members of one racial group or another, those actions are racist. The child welfare system, the education system, the healthcare system, the criminal justice system, and many other systems in America are fundamentally racist. End of story.
You know, before I turn the mic over to my co-host, Brother Alex, and our listening audience, those who is on the board and listening to the program, if you have any comments or questions, please hit 1. And we will acknowledge your last 4 numbers. If you'd like to make a comment or question as we talk to discuss this subject or topic, the state, the family, and the children, please hit 1. We acknowledge your last question. But Camille, again, it seems like we are being used as a tool where other folks can benefit and make money. You stated earlier there's an incentive to have foster kids, to take them away from families, because the big money in terms of people adopting them, not necessarily because they love them, but it's becoming money, another form of making money off of our. It's consistent of the history of the society. What can you say? How do you get past this money grab? Or creating means where people can make money again off of us and our suffering.
Well, I think one of the things that it's really important to do is we need to remember the way our ancestors did this. Our ancestors really do believe that it takes a village to raise a child. Our forebears, whether you're talking about your grandmother or six generations back, knew that the community has to band together to support each other in times of crisis. And that crisis might be economic, it might be a healthcare crisis, it might be Lord knows what, I don't know. But the fragmentation of our society, of our culture, the way that we are all suffering from post-traumatic slave syndrome, which is a term used by Dr. Joy LeGru, the way that we are all affected by these intersectional forms of racism, and not only racism, but there's a heavy element of misogyny. And by the way, God help you if you're LGBTQ, because being gay or bisexual or trans is a surefire way to get the ire of the social service system cast upon you. And if you recall, I talked about the way many of these services that used to be administered by the state are now being administered by private agencies.
Okay.
So you get these evangelical mm-hmm. Christian organizations that say you're going to hell if you're gay or bisexual or trans. And, you know, they not only do they treat the parents differently, they treat the children. I wrote a story, it was published in a magazine, about what happened to a young woman who was taken into foster care, who was lesbian, and how she was kicked out, I mean, literally kicked out of foster homes because she's gay, ended up living on the street and prostituting herself because she's gay. And she was cut off from her family of origin. Her mother ended up incarcerated. And this young, beautiful young child, this beautiful young sister, ended up in pure hell because of her sexual orientation, where they, you know, one foster parent said that they were going to beat the devil out of her, and another one said that, you know, tried to literally starve her. So, again, this is all intersectional, and unless and until we manage to liberate ourselves and to control the systems that are now controlling us, we're going to continue to suffer this. But even if you can't fix it, your awareness of it and your support of people going through it can literally make the difference between life and death for families, for individuals. And let me say that this can come to a home near you, because I sure as heck didn't expect it. It came out of the clear blue sky. We don't have any substance abuse issues. We don't have any incarceration in our household. We, you know, educated, orderly black people, you know, and it didn't make a damn bit of difference because, you know, one thing that all of us need to understand is that it doesn't matter how well you behave, how educated you are, or anything else. At the end of the day, you are a black person in America, and you're just as likely to get tackled by the police or to get affected by Child Protective Services as somebody who's doing wrong. We're talking about a country in which a Harvard professor, Henry Louis Gates, can get handcuffed for trying to find the key to his own house while black, where a minister, a college president driving while black, is likely to be yanked out of their car and handcuffed and slapped around. We're talking about systemic racism that affects you no matter who you are or what you do, just based upon the color of your skin. And that's what we have to band together and fight. But I would say to people who are dealing with problems with Child Protective Services, look for an organization in your state or a state near you where people who are advocates for your families and families like you can help you navigate these treacherous, shark-filled waters. That's one of the things that people can do.
Okay, so listen, audience, this is your PH Radio. We're discussing the theme, the state, the family, and the children. And right now what we're going to do is our line is open. If you hit one, we acknowledge your last four numbers, so we can go to our brother Alex. He's been listening real patiently, and I know a man of many experiences. Brother Alex, we're going to turn the mic over to you, and we'll let you have a daughter with our guest today, Sister Camille. Brother Alex, the mic is yours.
Yes, Sister Camille. And by the way, Hello, Mr. Lee. I've been listening patiently and been enjoying myself, but I've been overwhelmed by the horror stories that you have given us. But these are the same horror stories that have been around in America since we first got here. When kids were yanked from their parents as slaves and sold down the river. Some mothers got an opportunity maybe to send a child off on the Underground Railroad. Some of them got lucky enough to be taken maybe by a band of Indians that was passing by. Our children are our most precious commodity. And that's why our ancestors fought so hard to remain here in America and keep their identity. Though they lost their language, they lost their song, they lost their thought of even being a human being because they were treated as beasts. And they didn't want their children to live through that. And as we move forward, even in my own family, just as Camille said, there are stories. My family took in other women's children and raised them. Other family members whose fathers were sold, mothers were sold, left children behind. They raised those children, and those children had children. and they're considered dear family members today. Yes, it takes that community awareness of grandma, auntie, uncle, cousin, to band together and provide the necessity to raise someone else's child. Because at one point, millions of us were poor and had nothing. We could only depend on each other. Now there's a government agency that says they know better. There's a government agency that turns their back on the idea that a grandma can do some good. As our great-great-grandmothers use their breath to suckle their white master's children, they did more raising of their kids than they did their own. But yet and still, years later, we somehow don't know how to raise our own children. There are so many different things that need to be turned around with all these agencies when you look at the cost, the human cost, the emotional cost, the financial cost that is causing the African-American community to divide, separate, be at each other's throat because they don't know any better. When you don't have an identity, yes, somebody else's life don't mean nothing and I can pull the trigger. But when I think that everyone is my brother or my sister, I'm not going to shoot my mom. I'm not going to shoot my grandma. But when we lose our own identity, that we have no place in life, it seems much simpler to take from someone else because we didn't have. So we have to advance this theory a little bit further than what the departments or the governmental control, whether it's state or federal, because they get money. Foster care system, yes, from maybe $25,000 to $30,000, $40,000 per child annually. Some may get less, some may get more. But it is big business. And then it's big business moving on to adoption, just like she said. And then families take out life insurances on these kids. Some of them disappear when you add life insurance into that factor. There are so many different things and so many different directions that we can go with this topic in conversation. But the main thing is, what is a structure that we need to bring the family back together? Yes, that program, like she mentioned, of bringing someone into the family to teach a woman how to cook and sew and all these other things is just wonderful, and being a mentor. But also I feel like we need that male mentorship also. I volunteer for a lot of nonprofit organizations just for that factor, because I know there are a lot of foster kids there, and they don't have a father. So with these young men and these young women, they need that other voice. They need that male voice. They need that strength. They need that compassion. They need that insight. They need someone to make you dream and think about what I can do, where I can move, where I can go to make my life better. Because as long as you stay in one place, that's where you'll be. There's no movement once you stand in place. But once you start moving, then you start gathering stuff. You start gathering just speed alone as you move about. And you pick up and you learn. You meet new objectives in life. And you may want to go to college. You might want to be a doctor. You might want to be just a stocker at Walmart or whatever. But just be the best that you can be. And leave the law on their side, because the law has one purpose, and that is to carry out the law. And there are a lot of bad laws out there that you can easily be entrapped in. And until we can start changing these bad laws, these agencies will keep following the law because they have that law on their side. So I'm so sorry that what happened to you, Camille, is a travesty of justice, something that never should happen, not at all. But so many people, like you said, have your story and have a worse story than what you gave here today. But we need to hold people accountable. These organizations, we need to get together. We need to talk. We need to bring about some change because we are losing our community. We're losing our family. We're losing our homes because of this nonsense. And again, I appreciate all the tremendous information. I got a lot to think about from all the stuff that you said, and I will carry it forever. And I don't want to ask you anything because, believe me, it is just painful right now. And I'll give the other callers a chance to call in and make a remark.
Okay, Camille, for your response, yes, your final response for today, we're going to give a couple callers an opportunity if they have a common question that's on our board for a while. Caller, we can call our last four numbers, 4298. Give you a chance. If you'd like to say something, 4298. The mic is yours. Any question or comment, caller, 4298.
Thank you. Thank you. And greetings to the panelists. And it's wonderful to hear knowledge and research and paying attention to what's going on in one's community and getting involved in trying to fix the situation, because that's ultimately where the correct ideas come from and the struggle to fix it. And I just thank you for the information. I hadn't really planned on saying anything. You said hit one. I didn't hit one, so I thought I would be safe. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you for your comments, caller. You're just trying to fill in these missing pages. You're trying to tell our story. This is why missing pages of history came to existence. And I think one of the errors we made that we don't understand is that we refuse to tell our stories and control our stories and write our stories, but at least to tell them. Because there's an assumption of if no one said nothing, then nothing happened. So this is definitely why we are very thankful for Sister Camille coming forward and letting her experiences and her history and sharing her story, which is a part of our story, so we can begin to at least become more conscious of not only our story, but, you know, a lot of our stories have this common trend, and we realize we're all in this together. So to our listening audience, it's important for us to begin to understand our story. Because like they said, if we don't, who will? Now, we'll go to this call right here. If there's not a common question, Sister Camille, we'd just like you to sum up everything. Just give us your final thought on the day's theme, the state, the family, and the children. Let me see if this caller has anything to say. And caller, you've been on the board. You've been on the board for a while. Your last four numbers are 4488. 4488. Is there anything you'd like to say? Statement or comment. 4488. The mic is yours. Okay, I guess that caller has nothing to say. Camille,
well, no,
yes,
no,
your family.
I just wanted to thank Camille, Sister Camille, for the story. It's very touching, and that gives us, again, reason to just trying to strategize and, you know, see how we can learn from each other and regroup and find a way to, you know, to face these challenges we all have. It's the same thing that we have this, from my community, my perspective, we have this, our children who just born here and just been enrolled with the same issue than before. So we're still facing the same issue. And, you know, this is, we're learning from you guys because, like I said, we just came even 50 years ago, it's just meaning that we just came. So it's a lot of experience we are getting from interacting with our brothers and sisters who've been here long. We're learning, you know, we're still learning. We just, you know, we are inspired with everything, you know, the struggle, the resilience of our brothers and sisters here. So we really appreciate that you share this information with us. It just opened our eyes more. And thank you again. That's just what I want to add to what I said earlier. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlos, for your comment. And Camille, we'd like to hear your final thoughts on the theme, the state, the family, and the children. Camille.
My final thought is, again, there are many aspects to the destruction of Black communities in this nation. And the people who are on this call are people who are activists, are people who are dedicated professionally and individually and on a community-wide basis to the liberation of our people. And so I'm begging you to remember the children, remember the families who are most affected by this, and to fight like hell without ceasing to change the way that these systems impact our community. We've just got to hold the line on this. We've got to gain the knowledge. We've got to do everything that we can to change these systems of oppression because they are systemic. But step number one is recognizing where the oppression exists. And so that was the purpose of my conversation with you today, and I thank you for listening. In terms of my own personal family situation, that baby's going to be okay. It's going to be a struggle, but that baby's going to be okay because she's back home now, and her community, her village, is going to continue to sustain her as she has been sustained over the years. And so I'm saying reach out to families in your community that might need your assistance. Reach out and fight the systems of oppression, but also make yourself a part of the village because it can be literally the difference between life and death.
And Sister Camille, we'd like to thank you for telling your story and helping us to fill in this missing page of history as it relates to the state of family and children. We'll stay in touch, and at this point in time, we'll make a quick transition as we go to our commercial break with music and message. And when we come back, we'll be back with Brother Alex Joyner. He has a special message to the community. We'll be right back. This is MPH Radio.
Nobody knows. fast as the Beatles' new record again.
And the only safe place to live is on an Indian reservation.
And the band played on.
Eve of destruction, tax deduction,
city inspectors, bill collectors,
hardcore businessmen, population out of hand,
suicide, too many bills, hippies moving to the hills, people all over the world are shouting in the war.
And the band played on.
That's right. This is a world of a ball of confusion. And by filling out missing pages of history, we are coming to see clarity. And not only we learn what has happened and why it's happened, but put us in a better position to change it and create a world that we want to be. We invite you to come support MPH Radio and its organization by contacting us at PO 27782, Richmond, Virginia 23261. If you want to share some love to us, please feel free to do that. But more importantly, we are open for membership. We need more bodies, more minds, and be at this great institution. And you can contact us at mphradio@yahoo.com. Right now, we're going to our next segment, A Message to the Community by our brother, Alex Joyner, and we will now turn the mic over to Brother Alex. Brother Alex, what is your message to our community?
Well, my message to the to all the listeners and to the guest speakers, commentators today, callers, who provided some valuable information and insight. And if you have the opportunity, please go to some of the events that were mentioned earlier. But over the past few months, I have been watching the news coverage of the attacks on voting rights. It seems to be an all-out assault by one party, the criminalized, the undocumented, and the misinformed people of color's access to the ballot box, by any means. Our right to vote is being challenged by state laws influenced by a party who believes in the lies of voter fraud and election tampering. As President Biden stated in his address, have you no shame? No, there's no shame in the ones who tried an insurrection and failed. No shame in the ones who attacked and threatened the police. No shame in the ones who turned their back on the poor but support tax cuts for the wealthy. No shame in the ones that are in educational infrastructure. No shame in the ones who turn their backs on the elderly and prescription drugs escalating costs. They have no time or compassion for the ones who need a government that works for all Americans. They only have time for the privileged ones and the conspiracy fools who have infiltrated their agenda. They have made a base of discontent, hate, and oppressions for Americans who gave their service and lives for a better America. Now, where do we go from here? As Camille said, there's no place, and especially for you, like home. Home, relating to the place where one lives, to return by instinct to one's personal territory after leaving it, Webster's Dictionary. The house or flat that you live in, especially with your family, Oxford Dictionary. Your spirit, your home, is the place where you feel that you belong, usually because your ideas or aptitudes are the same as those of the people who live there. Collins English Dictionary. When millions of African citizens were stolen, kidnapped, beaten, and shackled before being shoved into the bowels of awaiting European ships with their great white sail, many took a last look at their homeland. They would never see it again. Their journey to the new world of North and South America proved to be the harshest test of a person's spirit and body. All of the Africans' freedom and justice were cast into the dark sea of distrust and dishonesty by men who cared only for the difference in appearance of their skin. The slave trade to America was in high gear, and among the natives was much fear. For those people of the dark continent, all hope was lost. After almost 600 years of forced slavery and disenfranchisement, the descendants of many tribes of Africa continue to seek a home. Some have kept the names of long-dead relatives, and some have had the opportunity to visit the homeland where mankind started. But where do you call home? Is home not the place where your forefather purchased a plot of land, cleared it, built a house? Is home not the place that every soldier prays to come back to after a long campaign of war? Is home not the place one returns to after a hard day of work just to relax? Is home not where the wife and kids make it a happy family? Yes, home is the security that every person should want. So why do I not feel at home in America? When I was a child, I remember the white-only signs and the Jim Crow law of segregation and separate but equal education. The shame of being a minority was cast down upon the race of the descendants of Africa. How my ancestors endured the worst treatment of any human being is incomprehensible to me. They endured this cruel and harsh climate in America and became stronger and more self-supportive than they will ever be credited for. How many succeeded or failed was due to many factors. The history of our ancestors cannot be overlooked or cast aside as if it did not happen. They were brave and honest people who made a home away from the land their parents were born, a home that could not go back to or find. The songs the slaves sung, the games the children played, the food the elders made, and the gods they prayed to are now lost. Only through DNA can we trace what area Africa our ancestors came from. Slavery may have died, but the horrors live on. A heavy and cruel hand has been laid upon us. As a people, we feel ourselves to be not only deeply injured, but grossly misunderstood. Our white countrymen do not know us. They are strangers to our character, ignorant of our capacity, oblivious to our history and progress, and misinformed as to the principles and ideas that control and guide us as a people. The great mass of American citizens estimate us as being characterless and purposeless people, and hence we hold up our heads at all against the withering influence of a nation scorned and contempt, as spoken by Frederick Douglass. The sunlight of emancipation gave way to the darkness of the hate in America. The darkness gone away. It is the shadow of freedom and equality. My home is being built in America. I am an American. I will speak out and speak up for justice and equality. I will be my brother's keeper. I want the truth to be taught in our public school. I want the right to worship as I please. I expect to sit on transportation wherever I please or can afford. I will march and protest when others are persecuted because they are a minority like me. I am part of the rainbow of human color. There's nothing that I cannot accomplish if I put my heart and my faith and do my work. My ancestors proved that after being taken thousands of miles from their homes, they could learn a new language and a new God and prosper. No other people have suffered more abuse from a country than they and still call America home. I will sit back and relax after a long day at work and think, what if they decided to just give up and die? Many made the choice to survive against all odds. Children, they would not know of verbal abuse, lynchings, beating by the whip, the constant fear of rape, the separation of families, the suppression of their freedom to to live and go where they please. And the rightful justice that the law was written for, but not enforced for them. Yes, one day, our rest in a better America. But am I only dreaming as they did 400 plus years ago? Love you, family. Now, thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Brother Alex, for your commentary and answering mine to our listening audience. And it's important that all views and statements that are made on this radio program are not necessarily the opinion and views of the radio station, nor of any of its members or associates. We seek to be a tool for the voice of the voices, and we like to create a platform where we can come together as communities, where we can all hear our perspectives. So on that note, we'd like to thank everyone for allowing MPH Radio for coming to their homes this evening. I remind you that our next program will be on the 31st of July at 1 p.m. Please share the word, spread the word. Again, we need your support monetarily, but more importantly, we need your support intellectually and to become active participants in helping us to build this institution. And you can contact us at mphradio@yahoo.com. And you can send your contribution and your love to mphradio at P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261, in the name of Mr. Page's History, Inc. Until next time, we'd like to thank you for participating and listening in. And remind you that the message you receive today of anything, the state, the family, and the children, is a message that must be heard, must be understood, and you too have a responsibility to come and help us to feel in our missing patient. So we end you with some music of messages and inspiration, and we see you on the 31st. This has been the voice of MPH Radio. Thank you for listening.
Choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you love your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you had your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
we'll make a better society. And if you have
Sisters, we